We'll hear argument now in the case of Hoppe against Lewis University.
May it please the Court, good morning. I will address four aspects of the District Court's ruling dismissing plaintiff's claims on summary judgment. Its finding that the plaintiff could not perform the essential functions of her job, its finding that Lewis University provided reasonable accommodations, that Lewis University did not waive its argument, that plaintiff could not prove her retaliation claim under the direct method of proof, and that there was no causal connection between the protected activity and the adverse actions. First, the dismissal of the ADA discrimination claim was an error because the defendants never pointed to any evidence that, that demonstrated what it perceived plaintiff's essential functions to be. In fact, there was no evidence cited in the record about Lewis University's essential communication-related job functions. The federal circuits have repeatedly held that defendants bear the burden of proving that a job is an essential function, that a job function is essential. In Ward, when a lab assistant's disability caused him to come to work late, the court found that the defendant did not meet its burden of proving that a given job was an essential function, stating that what is noticeably absent from the record is any evidence that the nature of plaintiff's position requires that he be present during specific hours of the day. The Northern District of Illinois' Local Rule 56.1 requires the moving party to file a statement of material facts as to which the moving party contends there's no genuine issue. When defendant introduced its essential functions argument in its summary judgment reply brief for the first time, it never amended its Rule 56.1 statement to include a fact about what Lewis University's essential functions are. The only evidence about what those essential job functions are in defendant's undisputed facts is testimony that the primary functions of a tenured associate professor at Lewis is teaching, scholarship, and service. And in that statement, defendant also conceded that plaintiff was able to perform those functions. In addition, defendant conceded in its answer to plaintiff's complaint that she could perform the essential functions of her job. That constitutes a judicial admission. Therefore, the court's dismissal of plaintiff's ADA claim on the basis that she could not perform the essential functions of the job was an abuse of discretion, because there was no evidence cited in the record that the limitations the court cited as essential, plaintiff's ability to check her email constantly, to check her voicemails constantly, were necessary for her position. In the alternative, the court's dismissal of the ADA claim was an error because the finding that she could not perform those essential functions identified by the court is not based on any appropriate evidence in the record. Plaintiff was able to perform the essential functions of her job. Not only did the defendant admit that in its pleadings and in the summary judgment initial motion, but the university failed to point to any specific instances in which plaintiff's limitations hampered her communications with colleagues or her communications with students. And in fact, the record contains evidence to the contrary that plaintiff was able to perform her teaching duties in an exemplary manner, did make herself available to students. Further, there's evidence in the record that Dr. Hoppe was able to overcome her limitations by seeking the assistance of others in order to check her email and voicemail to summarize the information for her. In addition, the court erred in finding that Lewis University provided a reasonable accommodation to Dr. Hoppe. When plaintiff began experiencing panic attacks and migraines in her office, she asked for an alternative office in a different location. Defendant claims that plaintiff did not provide sufficient information from her doctor in order for it to find an appropriate office. At the end of 2008, plaintiff's doctor provided two letters that specifically requested she be moved to an office that would be in a less stressful location In addition to these early letters, Dr. Hoppe directly communicated with the administration
about
this.
Didn't the university search for offices, four or five other offices, to accommodate that?
The university provided three offices that were within the same area that that Dr. Hoppe identified as triggering anxiety attacks. So it wasn't a good faith accommodation. And Dr. Hoppe communicated that to the university. There was an exchange about this. And Dr. Hoppe suggested alternative spaces in different buildings that were open, and the university failed to accommodate her. Another possibility would have been for the university to trade Dr. Hoppe's office with that of another professor. So the reason she didn't occupy the offices was that those offices triggered her anxiety.
But the physician's letter seemed to be kind of broad about what it was that Hoppe needed. In other words, it said something about away from the stressful condition, but it didn't say how far away, or that it had to be in a different building, different floor, what have you.
Right. So the dean herself witnessed the plaintiff having a panic attack in the area, in the office that was assigned to her. And that was the furthest one that was offered, was 66 paces away from the chair that caused her panic attacks. So the university knew, whether it was in the doctor's letter or not, that the offices offered did not meet her accommodation request.
So wasn't there a search beyond those three offices?
There was a search, but no genuine attempt to offer her an office outside of that area until years later. With respect to the plaintiff's retaliation claim, the first reason that it was improperly dismissed is that the defendant waived its argument with respect to one of the two methods of proving retaliation claims, and that is the direct method of proof, which overlaps with but is not the same as the indirect method of proof. The moving party bears the burden of establishing an absence of material fact as to aspects of the other party's claims or defenses. As the court made clear in Logan, only after the movement has articulated, with references to the record and to the law, specific reasons why it believes there's no genuine issue of material fact, must the non-movement present evidence sufficient to demonstrate an issue for trial. In this case, defendant did not even mention the direct method of proof when arguing that plaintiff's retaliation claim should be dismissed. It did not even assert the absence of sufficient evidence to establish a claim under the direct method, but rather argued for summary judgment under the indirect method of proof. In response, plaintiff argued that defendant had waived summary judgment on the direct method, but also presented an alternative argument that her claims did survive under the direct method of proof. And the district court did not address the waiver argument. Examples of ways in which that omission prejudiced the plaintiff are that defendant did not argue that plaintiff's circumstantial evidence of retaliation in combination, or each one piece standing alone, such as the timing factor, could not establish a claim of retaliation. Defendant did not present non-discriminatory reasons for certain of plaintiff's adverse actions, but instead argued that they were not adverse actions. It also didn't argue that there were no similarly situated individuals who were treated differently than Dr. Hoppe. And finally, Dr. Hoppe's removal from the aviation department was retaliatory. When an adverse action closely follows protected activity, that evidence alone can be sufficient to establish a claim of retaliation. In the Day versus Colt construction case, this court reversed a grant of summary judgment on the plaintiff's retaliation claim on the basis that the district court overlooked evidence which would have permitted the jury to infer that the decision maker knew the plaintiff complained, even though the decision maker did not admit to knowing about the protected activity. Because the adverse action happened within 4 weeks of the complaints, and because there was circumstantial evidence from which one could infer the decision maker knew about the complaints, there was sufficient evidence for the retaliation claim to survive.
Is there any evidence in the record of Hoppe's qualifications at that time other than her teaching the same course in the past?
Yes. The chair and the dean in place at that time assigned Dr. Hoppe to that course that same semester. So in September of that semester, they deemed her qualified to teach the course, and then later in that semester, after she sought an accommodation, they removed her from the course. And shortly thereafter, removed her from all teaching in the aviation department.
And she's still currently with Lewis?
She is, just not teaching in the aviation department. Here, the plaintiff, Lycan Day, presented evidence of close temporal proximity. The removal from teaching in the aviation came within weeks of her request for accommodation, within 3 weeks. And plaintiff presented other circumstantial evidence that could have led a jury to conclude that the motivation for her removal from the aviation was retaliatory. In addition, I see that the light is on. I will reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel. Ms. Yarch.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Rachel Yarch, and I'm here on behalf of Lewis University. I would like to make at least three discrete points this morning. And first is that Lewis University did not discriminate or retaliate against the plaintiff, Elizabeth Hoppe. In fact, the evidence demonstrates that Lewis University bent over backwards in an effort to accommodate plaintiff's condition by allowing her to modify her job duties, including her location, including the way in which she communicated with students, including her participation with her department, and in offering her 5 different office locations. Second.
Now, can you start with those office locations? Because as I understand it, they were, most of them until the last one, were all within the same proximity that caused the stress.
Well, first I'd like to point out, Your Honor, that Elizabeth Hoppe was never denied an office. At all times from the spring of 2007 till today's date, Dr. Hoppe has had an assigned office. Originally, she complained that she didn't want the office that was assigned to her, and she provided a doctor's note in August of 2008 which said the office causes her stress, so she needs a different office. But please keep in mind that Dr. Hoppe during that time period was teaching in the same vicinity where these offices were. So for Lewis administration to understand what exactly was causing her stress in that area when she never complained about her ability to teach in a nearby location was a stretch. Therefore, the Department of Human Resources said, we need some more information from you if we're going to accommodate the office request. But in the interim, they did offer her 2 other offices, which, as counsel pointed out, one was 66 paces away from the original individual who she identified that caused her stress. But as the course of these events unfolded, first it was the department chair who caused her stress, then it was former Dean Durante that caused her stress, then it was interim Dean Ayers who caused her stress, and finally it was the Vice President for Human Resources who caused her stress. So the stressors continue to change, and being that the second note from her doctor in September 2008 still didn't identify what was wrong with the office location or where an appropriate office location would be, Lewis had offered 4 offices at that time, and they asked Dr. Hoppe to provide some clarification and provided written questions that she could have her doctor answer that would enable the university to better determine where she could be moved. This was a situation where Lewis University had grown over the years and there was a shortage of office space. In order to displace certain employees, they wanted to make sure they had an understanding of what would be an acceptable office to Dr. Hoppe. Dr. Hoppe actually presented those questions to her physician, and he wrote some handwritten notes in response, and Dr. Hoppe failed to present that to the university, which resulted in a breakdown of the interactive process solely attributed to Dr. Hoppe. It wasn't until late December 2009 when Dr. Hoppe's physician finally wrote a 3rd letter which said she needs to be in a different building. And at that time, in early 2010, when that information was finally presented to the university immediately identified a new location that could be opened up for her. But in order to do that, 5 employees had to be displaced. So prior to the university actually bringing Dr. Hoppe into that office and giving her the keys, they asked her if it was acceptable. And uniquely, This was just before her second deposition. And I asked her under oath if the office location was acceptable, and she said it was. I asked both of her treating physicians under oath whether the office was acceptable, and they both said that it was. So Lewis University expended substantial resources in order to displace 5 individuals to make that office available for Dr. Hoppe, and then she's refused to ever use it. So we think that that Lewis University has adequately demonstrated that it has good faith, diligently attempted to accommodate Elizabeth Hoppe's condition to the extent that it understands it. I hope that answered your question, Your Honor. The second point that I would like to make is that the lower court here did not jump to conclusions, nor did it fail to construe the facts in the light most favorable to plaintiff. Rather, the lower court simply read the words on the sworn affidavit submitted by Elizabeth Hoppe in response to Lewis University's motion for summary judgment. That affidavit significantly changed the facts of this case, and I'll talk about that in a moment. Third, as the lower court pointed out, the only piece of evidence that could possibly raise an eyebrow in this case of retaliation are some handwritten notes on a memo of the minutes of a meeting between Bill Brogan and Dr. Hoppe, where she was informed that she would no longer be teaching in the aviation department. Now, those handwritten notes are not Bill Brogan's, but he did admit that those handwritten notes summarized his thoughts about the meeting. But the interesting thing is, he met with Dr. Hoppe in order to inform her that he had made his decision to remove her from teaching in the aviation department. So any opinions that he informed as a result of her behavior at the meeting are completely irrelevant to his decision to remove her from the aviation department. Now, plaintiff has alleged discrimination under the ADA, but she can't establish that she's a qualified individual under the ADA because she cannot perform the essential functions of her position with or without an accommodation.
Now, your brief in the district court identified communication with students, committees, fellow professors, and administrators as essential job functions. Where is that covered in the record?
Your Honor, there is no job description for a faculty member or associate professor with tenure at Lewis University. Rather, the bylaws of the university, which are in the record by way of affidavit through Ms. Graciela Dufour and I believe one of the deans as well, indicate that the responsibilities of a faculty member are teaching, research, service, and there's also collegiality. And I think it's inherent that each of those things requires one's ability to communicate. In fact, there's testimony in the record that teaching is the most important aspect of being a faculty member at Lewis University. It seems common sense that in order to transmit knowledge to students, that one must be able to communicate with those students.
Now, initially, you admitted that she could perform her essential job functions, but it seems that after the affidavit, that changed.
That's true, and I think it's because, obviously, plaintiff's condition changed. From the time that she filed her amended complaint, she alleged at all relevant times she was able to perform the essential functions of her position. At the time, Lewis also believed that she was, and she testified under oath, and she answered interrogatories under oath, indicating that she occasionally had difficulty checking her email, she occasionally had difficulty checking her voicemail, and occasionally had difficulty opening her mail. We know she couldn't office next to her department. She also missed department meetings, which is rampant in the record. She missed meetings with the deans, so that's some evidence that she had difficulty communicating. But for the first time on May 5th, 2010, and in response to Lewis University's motion for summary judgment, plaintiff submitted an affidavit that said that more than that she had difficulty communicating. The affidavit said that she at times can only check her email once a week and has to have her friends, her therapist, and her attorney summarize that email correspondence for her. That in and of itself is a violation of FERPA. Professors can't have others summarize their students' communications for them. That's an inability to perform one's job. Second, her affidavit said that she goes a month at a time without checking her voicemail, and that she goes a month at a time without opening her email. A month at a time, that's not occasional. That was a complete drastic change from the testimony that she gave at her deposition and from her answers to interrogatories. So Lewis had every right to change its position based upon the fact that plaintiff's condition had clearly changed at the time that she submitted that affidavit.
Didn't she have a separate email address for students that she said she could open that on her own without assistance?
She testified that she opened up a Hotmail account for students, which violated Lewis policies. Lewis expects its faculty members to utilize the Lewis email address, which is on the website and provided for people to communicate with faculty at Lewis. But when she testified about her difficulty with email, she didn't necessarily differentiate. So it is certainly possible that students were unable to communicate with her at that time. There is at least one piece of evidence in the record where a complaint was made to the dean where a student was unable to find Dr. Hoppe, and she was supposed to be available for student office hours. And as we know, she wasn't using her office, so she was trying to meet with students in the student union or wherever might be available, but she wasn't having set scheduled office hours, which, again, was a problem, and we believe an essential function of her position.
Getting back to this accommodation and the breakdown of the interactive process, now Hoppe disputes this in her sworn testimony, saying she repeatedly communicated with heirs about her specific needs. Isn't that a disputed fact for the jury to resolve?
Dr. Hoppe told Dr. Ayers that she didn't want an office near Dr. Miller. Dr. Hoppe, as a member of the philosophy department with a PhD in philosophy, also asked Dr. Ayers to change her academic appointment to the aviation department. And when she asked Dr. Ayers that, Dr. Ayers picked up the telephone and called the chairperson of the aviation department and said to him, Dr. Hoppe has an interest in being in the aviation department. Is there suitable office space for her there? And Dr. Hoppe has jumped to the conclusion in her briefs that that Dr. Ayers told Mr. Brogan that that she had requested an accommodation, when in fact that wasn't the case. All Dr. Ayers did was merely inquire about suitable office space. But there isn't sufficient evidence that Dr. Hoppe ever told or fully explained to Dr. Ayers exactly what the problem with the office was or what a suitable accommodation would be. And in any event, I think it was within Lewis's purview to request medical documentation of that. And they did request it. And Dr. Hoppe failed to provide that additional information that her doctor provided, and hence is the breakdown in the interactive process. I'd also like to talk a bit about plaintiff's allegations of retaliation. Basically, plaintiff listed a laundry list of things that she believed Lewis had done to her. And many of these things, we argue, do not constitute materially adverse acts. But in filing our motion for summary judgment, Lewis University was under the constraints of the local rules and Judge Kaur's standing order, which only allowed 15 pages of argument. Within that 15 pages, there were numerous allegations and five or six different counts, including the associational discrimination count, which is not before this court today. And Dr. Hoppe's allegations of retaliation stemmed from Title VII, Section 1981, and the ADA. And so to some extent, a movement for summary judgment must attempt to predict what the plaintiff is going to argue. And in that case, we did our best to attempt to predict that the plaintiff would argue all of the allegations of retaliation, and we defended them. We defended them under the indirect method, but we defended them nonetheless. In fact, we dedicated 7 pages of our motion for summary judgment to establishing why most, if not all, of the acts of retaliation were not materially adverse. And we argue quite extensively that the only act of retaliation which could be considered materially adverse was the removal from the aviation department. And in that instance, we argued that that Lewis University had legitimate non-retaliatory reasons for removing her from the aviation department, which included the lack of qualifications that she had to teach in aviation, and included her disruptive behavior on a field trip, which served to potentially compromise an important partner that Lewis had in Federal Express. We believe those same facts and that same evidence serves to prove a legitimate non-retaliatory reason under the indirect method, but also serves to prove no causal connection under the direct method. So regardless of the way the law was articulated in the original brief, the facts and the evidence were all there for the judge to determine that there was no genuine issue of material fact as to whether Lewis University discriminated or retaliated against the plaintiff, Elizabeth Hoppe. And to the extent that the plaintiff claims that we, waived an argument, I think the case law is quite clear that it's a stronger standard than that. In fact, last year, this court, in the Hernandez case, quoted the United States Supreme Court and said that that standard is really an intentional relinquishment or abandonment of an argument. The fact that Lewis University dedicated 7 pages to defending the allegations of retaliation is hardly an intentional relinquishment or abandonment of an argument. Your Honors, we believe that there's no genuine issue of material fact here, that plaintiff is not a qualified individual under the ADA, that even if she was a qualified individual under the ADA, Lewis University made every effort to accommodate her, and that any breakdown in the interactive process was solely attributed to Elizabeth Hoppe. At Lewis University did not retaliate against her. Most of the allegations are clearly without merit or not materially adverse, and that Lewis had a legitimate non-retaliatory reason in removing her from the aviation department, which was clearly articulated in the testimony and in the briefs. And we think that this decision should be affirmed on that basis. Are there any further questions?
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Anything further, Ms. Capitan?
I have a few points to add, Your Honor. With respect to the waiver claim that defendant just mentioned, it's true that defendants or movements in summary judgment are constrained with a page requirement. They can only use 15 pages. But so are the non-movements constrained by the same requirement. And if this court were to accept defendant's contention that they're not required to argue with respect to summary judgment on a certain element of a claim, and then the court can grant summary judgment based on that element of a claim, then it's essentially holding that plaintiffs have to prove every single element of all of their claims, whether they're at issue or not, whether the defendant points out that they're at issue or not. And that's a burden that is not required by Local Rule 56.1. In the Logan case, the defendant did not waive summary judgment because the defendant pointed out legal issues that would defeat a claim. So the requirement is not even that defendant go on at great length, or the movement, I'm sorry, go on at great length about an argument. They simply have to identify deficiencies in the plaintiff's ability, in the facts, and plaintiff's ability to prove the claim. With respect to defendant's contention that one of the offices, that plaintiff conceded that one of the office locations was acceptable, that's the office location that's not at issue in this case. And that's the one that was offered years after her initial accommodation request. With respect to defendant's contention that Dr. Hoppe's affidavit changed the facts in this case, in that affidavit, just like in her deposition testimony, she said that she had difficulty checking emails and checking voicemail. Not that she was unable to communicate, not that she was never able to check email and voicemail, but that she occasionally had difficulty and that she sought help with that email from other people. With respect to the allegation that plaintiff violated FERPA by having other people help her check email, this was never raised in defendant's motion for summary judgment. As was clear from the record, Dr. Hoppe had a separate email account for student mail than her Lewis account. There's no evidence in the record that that was improper, that that was against the essential functions, that it violated the essential functions of her position or prevented her from being able to do them. There is a reference in the record to one instance in 12 years in which a student was unable to find Dr. Hoppe. That was outside of Dr. Hoppe's office hours. One of the reasons it's so important for defendants to lay out what the essential functions of one's positions are is that different jobs have different essential functions, and the court shouldn't be making assumptions about what's required of a professor. A professor is, unlike some employees in some other fields, is not required to be in his or her office for 8 hours a day. Professors have office hours, and professors are not necessarily required to be in their offices available for students outside of that time. And unless the defendants produce evidence that that is required, then the court shouldn't assume it. Unless the court has further questions, I'd like to ask that the court reverse the summary judgment decision in the court below. Thank you.
Thank you very much, counsel. The case is taken under advisement.